This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Welcome, listeners, to the Christian Science Monitor News for Monday, October 20, 2025. I'm Mark Stangl from Mind's Eye, translating vision into audio. The first article for today is A Christian Science Perspective from Mark Swinney. It's entitled, A New Name, A New Spirit. If you were given a completely new first name, you'd have to practice identifying yourself differently. As you persistently wrote and rewrote your new name in your heart, though, you'd become comfortable with the change of ID. The first book of the Bible relates the experience of a person who was struggling mightily, but then he yielded to God's loving guidance in such a complete way that God gave him a new name. Thy name shall be called no more Jacob, but Israel. For as a prince hast thou power with God and with men, and hast prevailed. In her book, Science and Health with Key to the Scriptures, the Monitor's founder, Mary Baker Eddy, says this about Jacob's experience. He had conquered material error with the understanding of spirit and of spiritual power. This changed the man. He was no longer called Jacob, but Israel, a prince of God or a soldier of God who had fought a good fight. Could it be that today, too, you and I might also be so valued and loved by God that we'd see ourselves in completely new ways? Yes. When I was a little kid, my world revolved around exploring outside, playing baseball, watching cartoons. Then my parents began bringing me to the nearby Christian Science Sunday school class, where I was introduced to God. God is love, said a sign on the wall. As I learned about the nature of God as infinite love itself, I felt myself changing. I enjoyed thinking about God as love and even began talking with God. Getting to know God in this way also revealed a new sense of me as created by God, made spiritually, because God is spirit. God has created us to show forth his nature. Our true nature is not mortal or in matter. The spiritual reality is that we reflect God alone. God loves us all so much that he expresses in us changeless goodness, today and always. God's wonderful creation is never lacking. God expresses in all of us intelligence, balance, and goodness. As a spiritual offspring, we're created for God's glory. To recognize this even a little is so refreshing. It's like a new birth. I felt something of that as I grew up. And now as an adult, I continue to find that it makes a real difference, helping me to see the good in others, to be a better person, and to experience healing. Besides Jacob, two other individuals in the Bible were blessed with new names. Simon became Peter, and Saul became Paul. Each proved by his actions that the change wasn't superficial. It truly was a new beginning. Paul said, "This one thing I do, forgetting those things which are behind, and reaching forth unto those things which are before. I press toward the mark for the prize of the high calling of God in Christ Jesus." We too can look to a higher calling by yielding our hearts to God, becoming more Christ-like in the way that we think and act. We can humbly look to God, Spirit, love, for a whole new perspective on who we are as God's spiritual and loved children. To write and rewrite the new view, or this new view, in our hearts, letting go of our old habitual ways of seeing ourselves and others, is to embark on a journey of healing. As God has promised, I will put a new spirit within you. The next article in your Christian Science Monitor News of Monday, October 20, 2025, comes from Harry Brunius. He is the cover story editor of the Christian Science Monitor. His article is entitled, American Strength and the Freedom of Curiosity. In universities across the United States, the federal government isn't just a bystander to research. It is its principal patron. Washington has financed roughly 55% of university research and development in past years. About $60 billion of $109 billion in 2023, according to the National Science Foundation. If you include funding for independent labs and industry-connected facilities, total federal support for American R&D is on the order of $200 billion a year, according to the Congressional Research Service. The sheer scale of those numbers shapes a certain risk. What Washington funds Washington can control. Supporters of a more robust federal hand call this stewardship. The government should align dollars to a broader national mission, guard against waste and espionage, and ensure that public money serves public priorities. Their case is not frivolous. Control of taxpayer funds is part of a democratic accountability. Yet a government that writes most of the checks can be tempted to use its leverage to nudge the questions as well as the answers. At its worst, this can undermine the very ethos of free inquiry, a bedrock of science, discovery, and the American intellectual tradition. Free inquiry presumes that knowledge advances best when dissent is protected and curiosity roams with few fetters. If research funding lurches with every political cycle, or if decisions are made on an ideological basis, researchers might find themselves worrying more about how policymakers will perceive their work than about the research itself. Since taking office, President Donald Trump has also used funding cuts as a political cudgel, slashing research as a way to disrupt institutions he believes are mired in wokeness. Early career scholars and their international colleagues who come here to study are especially sensitive to that kind of pressure. The United States has long been considered a haven for free and independent study, even for outsiders. But as the stories in this week's cover package report, many are beginning to doubt that status. Can government funding be nonpartisan? Probably, not perfectly, but it can be non-capricious on both sides of the aisle. Congress can set broad priorities while independent agencies run merit-based competitions insulated by peer review. Guardrails against foreign interference can coexist with guardrails against viewpoint vetting. In the end, American strength and competitiveness will be measured, not just by how much money is spent, but also by the freedom and ingenuity of scholars who trust that their boldest questions still have a pathway in American higher education. Next in the Christian Science Monitor News of Monday, October 20, 2025, is the cover story. It's entitled, "The United States Used to Be a Haven for Research. Now Scientists Are Packing Their Bags." This article is written by Special Correspondent to the Christian Science Monitor, Colette Davidson, and staff writer to the Christian Science Monitor, Ira Porter. The Trump administration is putting pressure on top American universities and cutting funding. College professors and visiting scholars are starting to look for jobs elsewhere. This isn't the first time James Gerber and Lisa Hilbink have packed up their things and left. In the past 23 years, the married pair of academics have rented out their two-story house in Minnesota a handful of times. During sabbatical stints or fellowships, they've tucked away in boxes the family photos, handicrafts from trips to Latin America, and leather booties their children wore when they took their first steps. But this time feels different. "We'll do what we've always done in the past, pack things up and leave us," says Dr. Hilbink, sinking into a leather armchair in their St. Paul home. "But this time I'll bring certain special things with me, like my favorite photos." The two scholars are planning to move to the south of France this year, where they've been offered spots within the Aix-Marseille University's Safe Place for Science initiative. Dr. Gerber is a climate researcher. Dr. Hilbink is a tenured professor of political democracy. They don't know whether they'll be welcome in the United States when they return. "I hope it's just paranoia," says Dr. Hilbink, offering a glance at Dr. Gerber sitting beside her. "You prepare for the worst and hope for the best." The couple are a part of a growing number of academics and researchers leaving the United States. As government funding for scientific research dries up, and as President Donald Trump wages pointed attacks against some of the nation's top universities, more academics are looking to Europe and Asia as safe havens. A recent survey of United States scientists and researchers by the journal Nature found that 75% were looking for work outside the country. Some are doing so to protect their research, while others are trying to safeguard their individual freedoms. The result is a talent drain that has not been seen since World War II, but in reverse. Instead of European scientists seeking refuge in the United States, American academics are headed to Europe. For the researchers who have chosen to leave, it is bittersweet and professionally risky, but they say the future of science depends on it. A lot of us scholars value our independence, says Isaac Kamola, director of the American Association of University Professors Center for the Defense of Academic Freedom. We value the ability to research, write, and teach what we want, and do what we think is in the best interest of our disciplines. So when somebody comes and tells us, no, you can't say these words, you can't teach this book, this class, it's basically like saying to a doctor, you've trained for years to become a doctor, but we're not going to let you see patients. You'll have to do office work, says Dr. Kamola, who is also an assistant professor at Trinity College in Connecticut. Wendy, an anthropology professor in Minnesota, says she has worked too long and hard to throw it all away. When she saw a list of words banned by the Trump administration, she began to wonder whether her academic future was still in the United States. Gender, female, inequality, these themes are all part of my research, says Wendy, who asked that her real name not be used to protect her family. If you use any of these words in a grant application now, you'll get rejected. She studies religion and migration among medieval populations, but she has become increasingly worried about getting funding for her research, which relies heavily on the National Endowment for the Humanities. As part of its 2026 budget proposal, the Trump administration has called for the elimination of the NEH, the largest humanities funder in the United States, and in early October, the president fired 22 of the scholars serving on its 26-member board. It has also dismantled the National Science Foundation, the only federal agency that funds research across all fields of science and engineering, canceling over 1,600 active research grants. In August, the United States Supreme Court, in a 5-4 vote, allowed the White House to proceed with almost $800 million in cuts to research from the National Institutes of Health. The Trump administration's list of banned words is now at over 350 and growing, with words such as woman, climate, race, and housing on the list. It has also taken down from government websites decades worth of data related to climate change, health, and other scientific research. When Mr. Trump returned to office, he signed an executive order vowing to eliminate diversity, equity, and inclusion programs, including in higher education. That and the rollback in funding are part of what the administration sees as a corrective to what it considers a long leftward shift in higher education. The Education Department has also asked for enrollment data from universities to make sure that race isn't being considered in admissions and has launched investigations into what it calls rampant anti-Semitism on campuses such as Harvard and Columbia. This past year, Wendy heard from a French colleague that Marseille University launched the Safe Place for Science program, freeing up 15 million euros or $17.6 million in U.S. money to offer research grants to top United States professors. She, alongside nearly 300 others, applied immediately. Higher education is being silenced, censored, says Wendy. My job isn't at risk yet, but it could be. Ever since Trump was elected, my feeling was, we need to get out of America. In June, Wendy, along with Dr. Gerber, Dr. Hilbink, and 36 other candidates flew to Marseille for final interviews. The three of them were among the first 8 scholars chosen, as the university plans to make offers to about 20 candidates this year. As part of the initiative, the university is also pushing French officials to create a special immigration status of scientific refugee to recognize the current threat researchers face. More than 80 years ago, the United States welcomed exiled researchers to allow scientific research to continue while France hid in the shadows of Nazi Germany's occupation, says Eric Burton, the president of Marseille University, in June. I hope we can be a role model for this historic moment. During the 1930s, many Jewish scientists, including Albert Einstein, Eugene Wigner, and Edward Teller, escaped Hitler's Europe for the safety of the United States. Between 1939 and 1941, scientific exiles helped create the Manhattan Project and later the world's first atomic bomb. the period marked the beginning of what would become a tradition of collaboration between the United States government and scientists, spawning the National Science Foundation, the National Institutes of Health, and Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. Those agencies are largely responsible for everything from the moon landing to the internet. At the time, the United States was considered a land of freedom, a safe haven for people who were persecuted, says Annette Wierzbicka, a French historian and Holocaust specialist. Its universities were considered the most open-minded, and they welcomed researchers with open arms. Now it feels like the United States is closing itself off, that it's losing its position as a place of security, freedom, and creation. Francis I. Marseille University is one of a growing number of programs. Meanwhile, Germany, once the center of Europe's scientific exodus, is now opening its doors. Free science and free international exchange are key for social and economic progress, said leaders in a joint statement published in March by the Alliance of Science Organizations in Germany and the German Federal Ministry of Education and Researchers. We can and want to offer research scientists who no longer see the opportunity to work freely in their country a perspective within the scope of our possibilities in the German research system. European universities are up against one major challenge in recruiting American researchers: money. Despite Europe's financial investments, researchers who decide to cross the Atlantic often face hefty cuts to their salaries. An average salary for a full professor in the United States is over $155,000. In Europe, it is around 50,000 euros, or about $58,000 in United States money. American universities also offer other perks, such as paid relocation and subsidized housing. Wendy, the Minnesota anthropologist, says her salary in Marseille will be lower by about one-third. The university has promised to help her find housing, set up a bank account, and provide other necessities needed to start over abroad, but she expects to have to make some concessions. Her husband, a high school teacher, will need to find work. The couple will have to find a gymnastics club for one of their twin daughters while navigating a new city in a new language that none of them speak. Right now, I can walk to work. The girls' school is nearby, and we live close enough where the girls can go play on the campus football field on their own, says Wendy. Logistically, I've been having my doubts, but we'll go regardless. I'm thinking of my career long term. Other researchers feel similarly. They say they're willing to give up American comforts in order to feel safe. On a recent trip home from France, Brian Sandberg, a professor of European history, says he was worried about getting questioned at the United States border or having his mobile phone searched. I try not to weigh in on politics, says Dr. Sandberg from his home in Illinois. For the safety of his colleagues and students, he asked that his university not be named. But if it affects universities and academics, well, it would only take a Google search to see my views. Dr. Sandberg says that as a U.S. citizen, he is less worried about being denied entry and more concerned with threats such as online trolling. The real targets, he says, are international researchers and students. In March, a French scientist was denied entry into the United States after immigration officers found anti-Trump messages on his mobile phone. More than 300 international students have had their visas revoked since Mr. Trump took office in January. In June, the Justice Department issued a directive that aims to strip naturalized Americans of their citizenship in certain cases. Still, researchers have bristled at the idea of being labeled refugees. Doctors Gerber and Hilbink say they're uncomfortable with being put in the same administrative category as Ukrainians and Palestinians who face persecution and truly have to leave home. Observers are equally skeptical about creating a special status for scientific researchers. I don't think we're quite at the same level as during World War II, says Dr. Wierzbicka, the French historian. At the time, scientists weren't just at risk of losing their research, they were at risk of losing their lives. But for some American researchers, President Trump's policies have hit close to home, and their reasons for leaving go beyond career goals. Matthew, a tenured creative writing professor at a school in Connecticut, started thinking of moving his family to Barcelona, Spain in the summer of 2024. After realizing that Mr. Trump's views on transgender people would be low-hanging fruit for the new administration. Matthew's 13-year-old daughter is transgender, and he says he and his wife became fearful for their child's future. All we want for our kids is for them to have the privilege of not worrying too much about things that 13-year-olds and 11-year-olds shouldn't have to worry about, says Matthew, who requested his real name be withheld to protect his family's safety. I'm trying to make the best out of the situation. He was already on semester sabbatical in Barcelona to write a book and decided to extend it to an official leave of absence for 1 year. It took some convincing to get their two children on board, but they found a school and are all learning Spanish. What happens after the year is up, he cannot say. I love my job, says Matthew. My university has done a pretty good job of protecting academic freedom. It would be a heartbreak for me to have to leave my career. As much as professors and researchers might be contemplating a move abroad, crossing the Atlantic is not going to become de rigueur, says Dr. Camola of the American Association of University Professors. Established professors might be in a good position to leave, such as Tim Snyder and Jason Stanley, both of whom announced that they are leaving Yale University for Canada. But Dr. Camola notes, there isn't an abundance of positions for professors to move overseas, and some are tethered to the lives they built in the United States, such as taking care of aging parents or raising children. The unwitting losers might be future scholars. Potentially, you're going to have a lot of really young, smart students who are passionate about learning but won't go to grad school, says Dr. Camola. And faculty are going to be in a position where they have to make more and more concessions. Observers have warned that tenured positions will be increasingly vulnerable to political attacks and that the Trump administration could use moves from Florida Republican Governor Ron DeSantis' playbook, such as trying to ban materials from being taught. Scholars could find themselves censored or even censoring their own research. That could affect science as a whole, which has a critical role of independently analyzing someone's data, critiquing methods, and challenging old as well as existing findings, according to David Schley, Deputy Director of Sense About Science, a United Kingdom-based charity that promotes scientific evidence in the name of public interest. You can go across the world and see that authoritarian societies have a very strict control over what is published, what is disseminated, says Dr. Sheely. If one is looking at a list of countries banning books and freedom of speech, he contends, the United States is hardly going to come at the bottom. That said, he adds, it's just a huge shift we've seen, going from being a leader in science, innovation, and disseminating information to taking this huge step back. Wendy, along with Drs. Gerber and Hilbink, was among the first to receive an offer from Marseille University to teach. With all the hurdles of moving abroad, they're looking to start in January. They're also still wrestling with some grumblings among French researchers who have expressed resentment over university funding going to foreign researchers when local salaries are in dire straits. I have seen people online complaining about us, but there are only going to be about 20 researchers, says Wendy. I'm a little worried about how I'll be perceived. But it will be worth it, they all say, in the spirit of helping save independent science, one researcher at a time. I'm not an activist. I'm a scholar. But this is definitely a defining professional moment, says Dr. Hilbink, straightening her black-rimmed glasses. There are lots of opportunities closing, but this is also a great opportunity to collaborate. We could make this into something where we build an institutional relationship along the way. Next in your Christian Science Monitor news of Monday, October 20, 2025, is part two of the cover story. It's entitled, Facing Uncertain Future in United States, Chinese Scholars Ponder a Return Home. And this article is written by staff writer for the Christian Science Monitor, Ann Scott Tyson. With her newly minted PhD in international relations from the University of Washington, a Chinese graduate student had high hopes of landing an interesting job in the United States. but after waves of applications and rejections, she is now broadening her search to Europe and her native China. The challenges have increased a lot, says Don Wei, whose surname is being withheld to protect her privacy. The twin hurdles of the Trump administration's anti-immigration stance and billions of dollars in cuts to federal funding of universities and research institutions have made it much harder to find a job and sponsorship and stay in the United States, she says. That is why I'm looking for jobs in China. Don Wei's travails are not rare among the hundreds of thousands of students and scholars from China who make up a major pool of intellectual talent at United States schools and research facilities. Students from China earn nearly 60,000 doctoral degrees at United States universities between 2011 and 2021, far more than students from any other country. The vast majority were in science and engineering fields, according to the National Science Foundation. Policies that threaten to drive away such talent from American shores could lead to a talent drain that would weaken the United States' international dominance in higher education and technology, experts say. Some 277,000 Chinese nationals are currently studying in the United States. This is about to what extent the United States is still a welcoming society, especially for these Chinese scientists and scholars, says Yanbu Wang, Associate Professor of Strategy and Innovation at the University of Hong Kong. In May, Secretary of State Marco Rubio vowed that the State Department would aggressively revoke visas for Chinese students, increasing scrutiny of all future visa applications from China and Hong Kong. In July, President Donald Trump appeared to reverse that stance, saying that Washington would issue 600,000 visas for Chinese students over the next 2 years. But that drew harsh criticism from Mr. Trump's MAGA base, reinforcing the feeling among Chinese scholars that they are not welcome. The uncertainty impacts not only recent graduates, but also top-notch Chinese scholars who have been working in the United States for decades, says Dr. Wang. Suddenly, they realize, I thought I was part of this melting pot society. Probably I was wrong, he says. This has triggered many of them to rethink their career prospects. Moreover, the Trump administration's cuts to federal grants are forcing scientists to reconsider whether the United States is a research-friendly environment, he adds. China, on the other hand, is eager to attract talent from the United States and is now building upon the success of long-standing programs to recruit top overseas scholars to work full-time at Chinese universities. One such program, the Young Thousand Talents Program, established in 2015, offers leading early career STEM scientists from foreign universities generous incomes, housing subsidies, and startup grants. Different benefit programs appeal to older professionals. The offer of a lab-persuaded mid-career Chinese-born scientist Heng Jing Jiang to leave the United States after working at American universities for 20 years and join the faculty of Westlake University in Hangzhou. Someone showed me the lab space and I was so amazed, he says. It was my dream. I could have my own lab. Dr. Jiang, professor of mechanical engineering at Westlake, says his time in the United States was formative, giving him vital academic independence. I developed my own research style during 15 years at Arizona State University, he says. But Westlake, a research university supported by private and public funding, established in 2018, offered him fresh opportunities to apply his research through cooperation with industry. He dived into robotics, developing a humanoid robot in his lab and launching a startup company. He hopes to train his robot in a real-world setting later this year. I personally needed more space, a higher ceiling for my career, he says. Still, he acknowledges that moving back across the ocean is not an easy thing, especially for mid-career scientists. Indeed, so far, United States-based scholars such as Dr. Jiang, who returned to China, are in the minority. It's too early to see the real impact of the actions taken by the current U.S. administration, says the University of Hong Kong's Dr. Wang. For years, the overarching pattern has been for Chinese who earn doctorates in STEM fields to remain in the United States after graduation. About 90% of those graduating between 2000 and 2015 were still living in the United States as of 2017. And 83% of those who earned their degrees between 2017 and 2019 remained in the United States as of 2023, according to National Science Foundation data. For Angela, a student from China who graduated in June with a master's degree in education from the University of Washington, visa uncertainty as well as education funding cuts complicated her job search. The Trump administration had begun revoking Chinese student visas, she says, and it seemed as though she needed a green card to get a teaching job in the United States. She applied for about 100 positions without success. Angela, who asked her last name be withheld to protect her privacy, has been under a lot of stress. Her parents urged her to return to China, an option she was weighing when a friend helped her land a teaching job at a California middle school. "There's no perfect country in this world," says Angela. "But after evaluating my life and working conditions in China and the United States, I still feel like the United States is better for me." Your Christian Science Monitor News continues for Monday, October 20, 2025, with this article entitled, "The Supreme Court Has Given Trump Early Wins. Now it has to explain why." And this article is written by staff writers for the Christian Science Monitor, Simon Montlake and Sophie Hills. Since taking office, the Trump administration has notched a run of wins at the Supreme Court, which has overturned or stayed multiple lower court rulings. These emergency rulings, typically brief, unsigned orders, have served to greatly expand the power of the presidency and remove constraints on the executive branch. As the Supreme Court begins a new term, October 6, the legal basis of these rulings is facing fresh scrutiny. The justices, of whom three were appointed in President Donald Trump's first term, must issue reasoned rulings on some of Mr. Trump's most controversial policies, from emergency tariffs to birthright citizenship. The stakes are high for the administration, the contours of United States democracy, and the court itself, which faces searing questions about its political tilt and institutional integrity. If the emergency docket was a pit stop, this term is when the rubber meets the road. This is an administration in a hurry. It tries to push all obstacles out of its way, says Joseph Kubica of political science at Southern Methodist University. This is an administration that is incredibly aggressive about advancing executive power. The nation's highest court will be in the spotlight in an era of rising distrust. More than half of Americans disapprove of how the Supreme Court does its job, according to Gallup, with a 65-point gap between how Republicans and Democrats view the court. Gallup found 43% of those polled see the body as too conservative. Perhaps the biggest question is how an unpopular court would muster its own legitimacy to stand up to the president if his actions were unlawful. And if it does, would it risk seeing its rulings ignored or sidestepped, potentially upending the rule of law it is tasked to uphold? The court is terrified of having a head-on confrontation with the executive branch and making an order that the president won't follow, says Dan Farbman, a constitutional law professor at Boston College. What we're going to see is a balance between the court's institutional power, how much power it feels like it has, how many powers it is willing to exert, and its legal reasoning. There have already been reported instances of noncompliance by the administration with federal court orders, notes Aziz Houk, a law professor at the University of Chicago. This pressures the court not to confront the executive, since officials are suggesting they are willing to defy rulings that go against them, he says. But this political pressure makes it all the more important to impose lawful constraints and to see that they are carried out. A world in which the executive threatens something and the world accedes, regardless of the legality of the thing in question, is just as bad as a world in which the executive doesn't obey court orders, says Mr. Houk. There are different views on whether people should trust the court intrinsically. Some people believe the court should be viewed as legitimate regardless of its decisions. Others think the court is legitimate only when they agree with the rulings, says Mr. Houk. The Supreme Court was viewed with a large measure of distrust by state courts before the Civil War, he says. An interesting contrast today is you have this rumbling distrust coming not from state courts, but from lower court judges. What is Humphrey's executor? Among the politically charged cases on the docket are the firings of commissioners at independent federal agencies. The administration argues that these agencies are part of the executive branch and that board members serve at the president's pleasure. A 1935 Supreme Court ruling, Humphrey's Executor versus United States, has held that appointees can only be removed for malfeasance and neglect of duty. Judicial activists on the right have long sought to defang agencies that they view as overly independent and duplicative in ways that they have exacerbated government bloat. You have a majority of the Supreme Court that purely, clearly disagrees with Humphrey's executor, but has not yet overruled it, says Thomas Berry, director of the Cato Institute Center for Constitutional Studies. The Trump administration has fired senior officials at several independent agencies. One, Rebecca Slaughter, an appointee at the Federal Trade Commission, successfully sued. Her case, which was upheld on appeal, has been accepted by the court. A separate case concerns the Federal Reserve's Lisa Cook, whom Mr. Trump tried to fire over allegations of improper mortgage documentation. Analysts say the justices might be less inclined to lessen the Federal Reserve's independence, given its stature as a linchpin in the economy. Ms. Cook remains in her post. The court will hold hearings in January. Are President Trump's tariffs constitutional? Most of the tariffs imposed on foreign-made goods have been under a 1977 Act of Congress that had never been used for this purpose. The White House argues that its declaration of a national emergency allows it to impose global tariffs. It's hard to argue that this isn't the most important case of the term, says Mr. Berry. A decision in the case will have practical as well as constitutional implications. Importers have already paid hundreds of billions of dollars to the government that they would seek to recoup if the tariffs are struck down. Michael McConnell, a former appeals court judge appointed by President George W. Bush, has compared the tariffs case with Youngstown Sheet and Tube Company. In that case, the Supreme Court ruled that President Harry Truman could not take control of steel mills to supply arms for the Korean War. It laid down the principle, Mr. McConnell wrote in a New York Times op-ed, that even in an emergency, the president cannot take upon himself powers that are granted neither by the Constitution nor by congressional statute. If the Trump tariffs are upheld, it would be a major step toward a presidency that does whatever the president wishes to do, wrote Professor McConnell. How will they define birthright citizenship? The 14th Amendment states that all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. In a January 20 executive order, Mr. Trump ordered that United States-born children not automatically qualify for citizenship if their parents are in the country illegally or temporarily. A flurry of lawsuits followed, resulting in nationwide court injunctions against the order. In June, the Supreme Court struck down the use of such injunctions. The justices, however, left the door open to a class action suit, which the American Civil Liberties Union filed. Multiple judges subsequently blocked the executive order. In September, the Trump administration asked the court to rule on the merits of its interpretation of the 14th Amendment. The court ruling on court injunctions was a technical parsing of law that sidestepped the political minefield of who is and isn't a citizen. But if the court does take up the birthright case, it would be a stiff test of the porous divide between law and politics. The court takes great pains, and Chief Justice Roberts has tried to do this in his opinions and public statements, to say the court is not a political entity, but a legal entity, says Dr. Kobilka. Its institutional legitimacy rests on the idea that it is above politics, but that is increasingly challenged both by its partisan tilt and public skepticism. Unprecedented use of the emergency docket, 30 grants of emergency relief so far, has ratcheted up this tension, says Professor Hook. In one case, the Supreme Court overturned a ruling that United States Immigration and Customs Enforcement had unlawfully used racial profiling in its dragnet for unauthorized immigrants. In another in July, the justice allowed the administration to proceed with mass firings of federal workers. The Supreme Court has sided with the Trump administration about 80% of the time, according to a study by professors at Washington University and Penn State. In the lower federal courts, you have a mix ideologically of Republicans and Democrats deciding against Trump in about 95% of the cases, says Professor Hook. Conservatives argue that federal justices in blue states are overreaching by obstructing the Trump administration. Josh Blackman, a professor at South Texas College of Law, has called this a failed lower court revolt that threatens the judicial order. He noted that Mr. Trump also faced pushback in his first term. Other scholars say these cases result from confusion, not defiance. Emergency rulings that overturn federal court decisions, for example, on the removal of agency officials without formally overturning the 1935 precedent, leave lower court judges unsure how to apply the law. Formal rulings would end this dilemma, while also pitching the Supreme Court into the political arena, where it prefers not to be. Right now, the court's been able to sort of give the administration a break without having to fully defend itself to defend its reasons. But when it finally decides these cases, it has to actually write up the reasons for what they're doing. And that could mean big changes in constitutional law, or it could mean a confrontation with the president, says Professor Farbman. Your Christian Science Monitor news for Monday, October 20, 2025, continues with this following article. If I leave, what is left? Why officers battle Hegseth for women's right to fight. And this article is written by staff writers for the Christian Science Monitor, Sophie Hills and Anna Moline Grobe. Even before his tenure as the Pentagon's top civilian, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth's remarks about the service of female soldiers sparked concerns among many of them about their future. His speech to America's top commanders on September 30 fooled them as he emphasized that all United States forces should be held to the highest male standard. I don't want my son serving alongside troops who are out of shape or in combat units with females who can't meet the same combat arms physical standards as men, he said. Women have been officially serving in military combat jobs for almost a decade. After the speech, a general who was in the audience and requested anonymity to speak frankly said she was struck by the professional stoicism of her roughly 800 fellow flag officers. Many have traveled through the night after being summoned by the defense secretary to attend in person and in dress uniform. But as she and her staff waited at the airport for their flight back to their home base, she said she worries that Mr. Hegseth is creating policies that will help usher women and other minorities out of the military. It's a concern shared by many high-ranking military men and women as they watch the gains they spent their careers building being erased, and as they mourn the losses within the ranks of the younger women they had hoped to mentor. They're so smart. They're so innovative. They're so bold, the general said. And many are determined, she adds, to keep going. If I leave and other women leave, then what is left? On a podcast last year, Mr. Hegseth made no secret of his skepticism about women's military service. I'm straight up just saying we shouldn't have women in combat roles. Over human history, men in those positions are more capable. On September 30, he decried leaders who are promoted based on their race, based on gender quotas, based on historic so-called first that made the United States military less capable and less lethal. Shortly after being confirmed as secretary by a 51-50 vote, Mr. Hegseth fired Admiral Lisa Franchetti, the first female officer to rise to the Navy's top job as Chief of Naval Operations, as well as General Charles Q. Brown, who was chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and the first black officer to lead a branch of the United States Armed Forces. Less than 24 hours after his inauguration, President Donald Trump terminated Admiral Linda Fagan, who, as commander of the Coast Guard, had become the first woman to lead a branch of the armed forces. Now, those of us who are left, we don't have role models to look up to, says the general. By April, Official records of some of the first women and black troops to serve in the military were removed, in some cases temporarily, from Pentagon websites. Mr. Hegseth has done everything he can to erase the stories of minorities, including women, to erase their accomplishments, to fire them, to just get rid of them, says retired Colonel Ellen Herring, who was in one of the first classes of women to graduate from the United States Military Academy and is now a senior research fellow at Women in International Security. The secretary chose a benchmark year, 1990, for physical standards. Have standards changed due to a softening, weakening, or gender-based pursuit of other priorities? He wondered aloud in his speech. 1990 seemed as good a place to start as any. The choice of the year was no mistake, critics say. It was in 1991 that Congress first began to repeal the laws banning women from serving in combat aviation. By 2013, lawmakers had repealed laws barring women from combat. And in 2016, following 3 years of study, all frontline jobs were officially open to women. In the meantime, some 300,000 female troops have been deployed to America's wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, and elsewhere since 2001. During that same time, some 1,200 have been injured or killed in combat. Retired General Peter Chiarelli was tapped to command United States combat operations in Iraq in 2006 and served as the Army's Vice Chief of Staff from 2008 to 2012. He was also name-checked in the Defense Secretary's speech as the kind of officer that the Trump administration no longer wants to serve. Out with the Chiarellis, the McKenzies, and the Millies, Mr. Hegseth said, referring to four-star generals Kenneth Frank McKenzie, who led United States Central Command, and Mark Milley, former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, both of whom served in Mr. Trump's first term. General Chiarelli recalls that early in his time in Iraq, there was still pressure coming from Congress to limit the role of women in combat. "That created a huge problem for me," he told the Monitor. "The United States was fighting an Iraqi insurgency and needed medics, many of whom were women, to be assigned to more dangerous positions. I encouraged our commanders to go ahead and do it, to put women in those positions," he says. "They performed magnificently." Religious undertones? There has been concerns among some military officials about the religious undertones that they see accompanying Mr. Hegseth's reservations. In August, Mr. Hegseth reposted on his X account a CNN segment that featured a pastor, Doug Wilson, who is often described as a Christian nationalist. In the CNN report, Mr. Wilson said he doesn't believe women should hold leadership positions in the military. A statement from a Pentagon spokesperson following Mr. Hegseth's ex-posting said the defense secretary is a proud member of a church affiliated with Communion of Reformed Evangelical Churches, which Mr. Wilson co-founded, and very much appreciates many of Mr. Wilson's writings and teachings. Since Mr. Hegseth became defense secretary, the Military Religious Freedom Foundation has received a tsunami of calls, says Mikey Weinstein, a former Air Force officer and lawyer and the group's founder. Complaints about sexism in the military are also about three times higher than they were last year, he says. A former Army chaplain who spoke on background said that there has been progress as the Pentagon took on misogyny and military sexual assaults in the years since women have first served on the front lines. But in the Trump administration, men appear to be freer to say and do what they like, the former chaplain added. He now serves as what's known as an ecclesiastical endorser, a federally vetted liaison between churches and the Department of Defense. Many of the chaplains he is responsible for are women who are feeling scared and they're discriminated against, he says. Women are leaving prematurely from a career or choosing not to pursue it at all. Cecilia Bradford, a chaplain in the Army Reserve, says she has come face to face with fellow chaplains who didn't believe women should be in ministry. But she is also driven by the conviction that she can make a difference. Now, she says, she wants to make sure that we continue on. The field has been dominated for so long that if we don't leave our imprint, it could very well go back to that. Other new standards. That's a concern shared by the general at Mr. Hegseth's speech. We've worked very, very hard to attract and keep women in the military, she says. The Trump administration is actively working against what I've worked for, and it blows my mind. Mr. Hegseth touted the work his department has done in the past month to remove the social justice garbage that has infected the military. No more identity months, DEI offices, dudes in dresses. No more climate change worship. No more division, distraction, or gender delusions, he says. At the same time, he endeavored, it seemed, to offer some reassurance, stressing that both racism and sexual harassment are wrong and illegal. Infractions, he added, will be ruthlessly enforced. He also said that America's female troops are the absolute best in the world, and that defense officials very much value their impact. As far as combat jobs go, if women can make it, excellent. If not, it is what it is. If it means that no women qualify for combat jobs, so be it, he added. This is not the intent, but it could be the result. There will be women who qualify among the many who have already surpassed gender-neutral standards, says Dr. Herring, pointing to the 170 women who currently serve as Rangers, an elite branch of Army Special Operations Forces. What Mr. Hegseth doesn't recognize or acknowledge, she adds, is that once you finally let women compete, many, many, many women have successfully done all the things he thinks women can't do. Next in your Christian Science Monitor News of Monday, October 20, 2025, is Global Patterns by Ned Temko. His article for today is entitled, Trump Tests a More Diplomatic Approach to China. United States President Donald Trump's campaign-style performance at the United Nations in early October manifested his approach to other countries, shunning the strategizing and engagement of past administrations and changing policy with each speech. But there are signs he is reverting to more traditional diplomacy toward Beijing. The mode of United States-China relations remains competitive. A tough line toward Beijing is one of the few policies for which there is still bipartisan support. Yet, since earlier this year, when he dramatically escalated his first-term tariffs on Beijing, Mr. Trump has been looking to build a more stable, sustainable, and respectful relationship. The latest sign came before the General Assembly, when the two leaders spoke by phone for the first time since June. They agreed to meet in person during a summit in South Korea at the end of October. Mr. Trump said he had agreed to visit Beijing early next year and that Chinese leader Xi Jinping would come to the United States at an appropriate time. Issues of substance continue to block the way to anything resembling a real rapprochement. Most immediately on the agenda is the future of the Chinese-owned social media platform, TikTok. Congress has mandated that its United States operation be placed under majority United States ownership or shut down. United States tariffs on Chinese exports also remain an issue, down from their maximum of 145% in April to around 30%. China wants the White House to ease export restrictions on high-tech items, and Beijing does not want Mr. Trump to take a hard line on Taiwan, the island democracy. Mr. Xi has vowed to reunify with the mainland. For Washington, outstanding grievances include China's production of the precursor chemicals for fentanyl. United States officials are also unhappy of how Beijing is helping to cushion the impact of Western sanctions against Moscow. Still, Mr. Trump's patience and restraint are in sharp contrast with his approach to the rest of the world. He told Western European allies from the UN podium that their countries were a mess, and he used his social media platform to make a U-turn on Ukraine. After repeatedly denigrating Kyiv's prospect in the war, he declared out of the blue that Ukraine could, with NATO support, defeat Russia outright. The United States president has avoided aiming such barbs as Mr. Xi. He overrode Congress by unilaterally delaying TikTok's shutdown order. When he used tariffs to crack down on countries buying Russian oil, he left untouched President Vladimir Putin's largest oil customer, China. And in June, the White House told Taiwan's president not to make a planned stopover in New York. Mr. Trump's transactional view of world politics means that a change of direction cannot be ruled out. But he appears unlikely to impose on China the kind of policy seesaw he applied to Russia and Ukraine. Part of the reason that Mr. Trump initially wooed Mr. Putin with a Russian-friendly plan for ending the war in Ukraine was to pave the way for an end to U.S. sanctions, for a new economic partnership, and for a bid to pry Russia away from its alliance with Beijing. Yet even if Mr. Trump again changed his tact on Ukraine, he seems increasingly to have recognized that Russia is a minor player on the world economic stage. China, on the other hand, is unarguably a major economic power, and it is not without leverage. When Mr. Trump agreed to an interim deal lowering the sky-high April tariffs, the move came on the heels of China's announcement that it was halting exports of products on which advanced United States civilian and military industries rely. In other words, Mr. Trump's more malleable approach to China might bear out a core tenet of traditional diplomacy. Even countries not minded to be friends sometimes need each other. Next in your Christian Science Monitor News of Monday, October 20, 2025, are articles from the Global Newsstand. From The Guardian in Sydney, people deserve to be represented in all their complexity. Time and time again, the story of the Arab migrant appears in the media in narrow and damaging ways, says Ula Ghanoum Nuha Francis and Mariam Matouk, members of the Don't Ask the Trees Collective, a group of Arab-Australian writers. What is rarely seen is the complexity of who we are. In recent years, Arab-Australians have refused silence. Writers, poets, journalists, and performers are reclaiming narratives once reduced to stereotypes. This growing body of work is a reminder that people do not abandon their homelands lightly. Those who leave carry profound loss, but also fierce determination to begin again. What is needed now is recognition. Publishers must embrace Arab-Australian work. Media must move beyond cliches, and readers must be willing to listen. From the Telesur in Caracas, Venezuela, renewable energy costs too much on its own. Renewable energy has become a significant part of electricity generation, writes Hatem Al-Gayas, Secretary General of OPEC. While we do hear talk of falling costs for renewables, it is important to look more broadly at the true costs of the expansion. Strains on electricity grids are quickly becoming apparent. Renewables are heavily subsidized. A further consideration for wind and solar energy systems is the cost and availability of essential materials, as these technologies are highly mineral intensive. It is crucial to be pragmatic about energy systems. Oil and gas provide a stable, affordable, and reliable source of energy. From the Arab News in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, modern cities need modern transportation. Today, a confluence of factors is highlighting the pressing need for the modernization of transport in the Middle East and North Africa region, writes Sarah Al-Mula, an Emirati civil servant. The United Nations estimates that the region's population will double by 2050. Urbanization rates are also intensifying cities' densities. Moreover, cities are pegged to meeting ambitious climate targets. The intersection of rapid population growth, climate change, and economic success poses the need for more investment in the transport industry. Against this backdrop, the success of cities will increasingly depend on whether their transport systems meet the evolving needs of their bustling economies. And you have just heard the Christian Science Monitor News for Monday, October 20, 2025. I'm Mark Stangle for Mind's Eye, translating vision into audio. Thank you for listening, and have a great week.